Well, good afternoon, everybody. Pretty sweet morning of practice. Thank you. So this is the time of year that I'm always thinking about the story of the Exodus, the escape, the liberation from Egypt, which is the main practice of this holiday, to remember that story. And it makes you wonder, what does liberation actually mean? What are we wanting to be liberated from? What do we want to be liberated for? And the usual way of taking the story is at face value, which is that we were free from slavery a long time ago, now we're free. And maybe we understand freedom in social and political terms, and that's why we are and always have been so sympathetic to anybody else who's oppressed and under political oppression and yearn to be free, and we're always on their side because we experience the same thing. And that's almost always the way we take it, and that's the best way to take it. To understand God really doesn't want people to be oppressed by other people, that God wants them to be free just the same way that God wanted us to be free and freed us. So that's what this story reminds us of. But at the same time, in the light of our sitting practice and of our deep introspection, we can see the story in other ways too, in more mysterious ways. I was mentioning that this is our third and last meeting, and in one of the other meetings, Dorothy was discovering sources that talked about preparing for Passover, and I guess, you know, in a way it's really obvious, but I don't think I ever heard it before, and she said it was new to her too, that the preparation for Pesach begins with Purim. And then I was reflecting, you know, on Purim, this very profound thing where they say, which is taken to be jokey, but I think it's very profound, have some schnapps, you know, and drink enough of it so that you don't know the difference. When you hear Haman and Mordechai, you can't tell the difference. So you can't tell the difference between good and evil. You can't tell the difference between the bad guy and the good guy. You can't tell the difference, maybe, if that's the beginning of the preparation for Pesach, maybe we can't tell the difference between freedom and bondage. Maybe that's where we start, not knowing the difference between freedom and bondage. And then I remembered that this is never emphasized in the story, but actually Moses is asking Pharaoh not for some global or total release of the people from bondage. He's asking only that the people be released so they can go out into the wilderness to do service to God. That's all he's asking for. And you'd think the Pharaoh would say, you know, no problem, but I guess maybe the Pharaoh didn't believe that's what he really was intending, or maybe the Pharaoh thought if they did go out to the wilderness to pay service to God, they would never come back, something would happen to them and they wouldn't come back. Anyway, they weren't asking for total liberation, they were asking for just being able to commune with the divine. So maybe there isn't any difference, really, between liberation and freedom. Maybe it's just a matter of who your master is going to be. Who are you going to serve? Are you going to serve Pharaoh because you're compelled to do that, forced to do that, under threat of violence? Or are you going to freely choose to serve God? So maybe the freedom isn't the question. The question is, you know, who are you going to serve? The word mitzvah means commanded, And Dorothy and I were over at, you were there too, over at Chachmat, and we were talking about being commanded, and we were saying, ah, that's bad, you know. Who wants to be commanded, you know? I said, oh, it's so oppressive, you know. Judaism is so oppressive. God is so pushy, so demanding of all these different details, you know. I mean, do we really want that? Don't we want to be free from that? So, yeah, I mean, I guess by the way we think about things now, we want to be free. We don't want to have restrictions. We don't want to have a bunch of rules imposed on us. We want to be able to do what we want. We want to be able to be who we want to be. So the God of the Torah is a mixed bag, you know. This God is too insistent, too pushy, too... This God does not really care that much about our autonomy, does he? No, not really. And that makes sense. You know, I think we can all relate to that. But my point of view, that comes from a long life of looking deeply at my own experience, is that I am my own Pharaoh. This is what I see. That if I am left to my own devices to be who I want to be and pursue what I want to pursue and grab my desires, that's not a good life for me. That doesn't make me happy. I've seen this, you know. And it doesn't even make me free, because I'm now under the compulsion of those impulses, and I'm never satisfied. I notice this, you know. I am never satisfied, ever. And I'm never going to be satisfied. And anyway, above all, the one thing that I do not want, and I'm clear on this point, is to die. I do not want that. And yet, I can pretty much count on the fact that I won't be able to prevent that from happening. So how free am I? So, on reflection, I think that I would rather freely choose to be commanded by something wiser and greater than my own inner Pharaoh. I would like to be commanded to live deeply and in accord with what I more truly am, not what I foolishly and automatically assume that I am. And so I was reading in one of from this book of mine, which I really like this book, The Museum of Capitalism. It's a book of poetry. Last time I read my poem about being commanded, I'm going to read it again, except last time I didn't point out that this is a very odd book, because it's not really a book of poems, it's poetry. But it's one thing after another, poetry. It's not like discrete poems, each of which say something. It's a meandering, one long poem, each part of which sort of relates to the last part. So I didn't read the little part that precedes the part about commanded. So I'm going to start there this time. Because the poem about being commanded has to do with living in time. Since we live in time, we need to be commanded. So this is the beginning part. Time that is intolerant of the brave and the indecent. Time that makes strange excuses for itself, that keeps on repeating its broken melodies as they come dangling various sticky silken threads. Time as master of fate and healer of wounds, and so forth, and so on, and on, and on, and so forth, and so on, or so-so, and so-and-so, or such-and-so, or thus-and-so, where time is viewed as an ocean things swim in, but there are many special cases of time being out of time, or just in the nick of time. Time as death is sleep, as time's deceptive lingo, which is abstract. Time is abstract, but change will always change you. This is a passage about a sea voyage. And here is a passage about a team or a pillar on an overpass. This passage describes retail stores in a foreign nation. And here we read of a man dangling from a roof. There is no coherence, save that two minds cohere at a point where all goes dark. Life is heat. Monday, a time to find one's double. Tuesday, a dream of purifying fire. Wednesday, a discussion of possibilities. Thursday, all political arrangements flap in shattered daylight by now. Friday, already glimpsing an end. Saturday, commanded, meaning disclosed. Sunday, harsh desert heat makes the mind range or rage, signifying nothing. Tuesday, winter not arrived. Wednesday, a flash of innovation around the eyes. Thursday, already by now thinking of doom. Friday, nearly finished, time to stop, shop, time to shop. Saturday, commanded, meaning not to be depicted. Sunday, outside all available channels. Monday, because of crimes. Wednesday, absolutely no rhythm. Thursday, surprising that you'd like this. Friday, already by now a sense that the wool's being pulled over your eyes. Saturday, commanded, meaning absolutely still. Sunday, disasters come in pairs. Monday, somehow you deserve this. Tuesday, so many fingers it's impossible not to take one in them to be chained. Thursday, heartache. Friday, considering the origins and the timetables. Saturday, commanded, being inserted outside it nowhere. Sunday, a confusion of identity swirling around. Monday, bearing the weight of being. Tuesday, two planets side by side at night. Wednesday, hate, fate, or debate. Friday, my end is my beginning. Saturday, commanded, furiously. Sunday, hardly able to proceed. Monday, debate, but without means to reach provisional conclusions. Tuesday, termination. Wednesday, entirely lacking bones. Thursday, ending midstream. Saturday, commanded insatiably. Sunday, proceeding according to determinations. Monday, having to make something for something else. Tuesday, stars in the sky. Wednesday, underlying sound of bells. Thursday, heartfelt fears causing you to back away. Friday, straining for the ever-present beginning. Sunday, time could be arranged in any way. Monday, music has no structure. Tuesday, disdainful. Wednesday, overreaching. Thursday, orchid. Friday, sorrow. Saturday, commanded. So I mentioned before that this other fantastic teaching, the 10 days of tshuva before, during the first 10 days of Nisan, and the text that I think is the tshuva of love text is the Song of Songs, which I haven't read in a long time, and I think I recommend. I'm gonna read it during these 10 days, and I recommend that you read it and study it. It's the great text of the Jewish mystics about union with the divine, the tshuva of love. And it's springtime. Doesn't springtime always feel like love? At our house, the tulips are in bloom. Kathy is so excited. She can't. She's always dragging me outside to look at the latest thing that's going on with the tulips. And the new animals are being born, and the grass is coming up. And life is asserting itself. You can't stop it. At the beginning of the Seder, we chant the Seder, the order, right, of the things that are going to happen in the Seder. And the purpose of the Seder meal is to, and so many things in Judaism are like this, right, to remember what happened before, so we don't forget. So remember what happened in Egypt and beyond. And then, you know, every year we imagine that it's happening again. It's as if these tremendous tropes, whatever they mean, happen over and over again in time, as if time has particular wrinkles that at a certain time of year appear again. So we're remembering. Remembering is a big deal, right, in Judaism. But the word remember actually is the same thing as to be mindful, right? In fact, the Buddhist word for mindfulness in Pali and Sanskrit does mean to remember, to keep in mind, to return to mind, to remember, to be present, to remember to come back to the present, to come back to what our life is, to come back to what exists here. And so I'm pretty convinced myself that the Jewish practice of remembering is only apparently about remembering the past. Certainly it is about remembering the past, but not only that. It's also about remembering the present and renewing ourselves, reconstituting ourselves always in the present. So we chant the Seder. There are 14 one-word items in the Seder. Number one, recite the Kiddush, drink the first cup, and then we say the blessing over the wine. Thanks God for choosing us. Thanks for freeing us from Egypt. Thanks for giving us Shabbos. We mentioned Shabbos because that's the ultimate commanded, as in my poem, the ultimate commandment, and all the holidays. And then the second item is washing the hands, which we're told we do without a blessing, I guess because we're not eating yet. The third item is karpas, eating a green vegetable, usually the parsley. We make sure you get the parsley and you dip it in the salt water because parsley reminds you it's spring and life is coming and the salt water is the tears. The fourth item is yachatz, breaking the middle matzah. These are the first four items. They take very little time. But then the fifth item is magid, telling the story. And the sixth item is rochatz, washing the hands before the meal. There's a long time between the fifth and the sixth item. So the fifth item takes a long time. And most of the Seder proper, before, you know, the blessings after the meal, and the songs and all that, most of the Seder proper is Magid, telling the story. That's the most important mitzvah, right? To tell the story. So I got my old Haggadah, you know, that I've been using for my whole life, pretty much, and I said, okay, how did they, I never thought about this. Let's see how they tell the story. So it starts with holding up the matzah. You all know this, and saying these great lines that are very stirring, really. When you hear them every year, I'm always moved by them. You hold up the matzah. This is the bread of affliction, which our forebears ate in the land of Egypt. All who are hungry, let them come and eat. All who are needy, let them come and celebrate the Passover with us. Now we are here. Next year, may we be in the land of Israel. Now we are slaves. Next year, may we be free. That's how we start telling the story. So it's interesting to think about those words. In the first, we're remembering. We have a past, a very long past, and it matters. It matters to us, and we're going to keep remembering it. And maybe we'll never understand it, or every year we'll understand it differently. So that's the first thing we're saying. Second, we somehow managed to make bread out of our affliction. That's pretty good. You know, we've made bread out of our affliction. And when we eat it, we're going to eat it not only to remember for ourselves, but we're going to eat it with reference to everyone else. Everyone is welcome to join us. We say, you know, everyone's welcome to join us. Everyone who's in need is welcome to share this food with us. Everyone can join us in celebrating our freedom, which we hope is their freedom too. So that's kind of beautiful that we start with that. But the ending is a little strange. Did you ever think? Now we're here. Next year, may we be in the land of Israel. Are we really saying we want to have Seder next year in Tel Aviv? I don't think that's what we are saying, especially when you consider that we've been saying this for a long time, before 1948. So for many thousands of years, a couple thousand anyway, I think what this line meant was, here we are now in the mundane world with all of its troubles. Next year, may we be in the transcendent imaginary, the Holy Land of Israel. But the meaning of that line changed in 1948, because now there has to be a literal dimension to this statement. Although, as I say, I don't think we're really saying we're booking tickets, you know, next year for the Seder in Beersheba or something. But the line is different now. And as we know, the practical, political land of Israel, well, still, maybe in our hearts, many of us, remains a land of the transcendent imaginary. I know it's that way in my heart. It is also a literal, physical place, which has been for some time and is now possibly more than ever a terrible instance of contemporary political reality and all that goes with it. So this is a terrible line, I think, to recite and, you know, hold in heart this year more than ever. And we're still trying to understand and digest this. And probably this year at Seder tables around the world, when we recite that line, we're going to all be taking a breath. I don't know what we will know or understand by it, but I think we'll all be certainly moved by it. And then what about this line, now we are slaves, next year may we be free? But wait, isn't this a story about how we were slaves a long time ago and we've been freed for thousands of years? How are we still slaves? Is it because we're not yet free of ourselves? Is it because we haven't yet realized, you know, who we want to be and need to be? Or is it just simply we're not free yet of the obligations of the and the insanity of the world we live in? I mean, what does it really mean to say we are now slaves, next year we want to be free? Whatever it means, it must mean there is something as yet oppressive in us, something that we hope will be different, something that we want to be lifted from us next year. It's a strange line, and I commend everyone to think about it this year and take time to contemplate it after you say it. So anyway, that little paragraph with all of its complexities is the beginning of the telling of the story, and then comes the four questions, and then the four sons, and the four questions are supposed to elicit the telling of the story, so the story is told, but actually, in the traditional Haggadah that I have, the story is never told, ever. You know, they don't tell the story. We have various debates and interpretations of the rabbis about various things. You know, this one says this, that one says that. And then before we know it, we're dipping our fingers in the wine and saying the plagues, and then we have lots of different interpretations about how many plagues are there and what do they mean, and are there 50, are there 250, you know? And then we sing Dayenu, right? And then we say, well, you have to explain three things, the offering, the Passover offering, the matzah, the moror. Then we drink the second cup of wine, and then we eat the matzah. And this is Rabbi Lu's practice that we do every year, and I recommend eating a very large, uncomfortably large piece of matzah in total silence while everybody is crunching around the table. And we should all be totally silent, because eating the matzah is the mitzvah and is the moment of freedom. We're tasting our freedom. Then the Hillel sandwich, then the meal. So we don't tell the story. Actually, the story is not told. So maybe they're saying, well, you know, in our time, the way we tell the story is the rabbis and their debates. So pay attention to that. That's the story. Maybe they're saying that. I don't know. But in our seders, we've always tried to say, everybody around the table, you tell the story. Tell whatever part of the story that you remember or that's important to you. And that's been, we've had mixed success with that. Because the children don't want to do that, and the grown-ups haven't thought about it and don't take it seriously. So, you know, it hasn't been that great. But it's just sort of noteworthy that we're supposed to tell the story, and we don't. So therefore, I'm going to conclude by giving you some of my thoughts about the story this year. Just the very beginning of it. Not all the important parts, the dramatic parts, just the beginning of the story. So I have Robert Alter's fantastic, thick translation of the whole of the Tanakh. And he gives an introduction to each of the five books of Moses, not too long. And here he points out, this is from his introduction to Shemot, the Exodus. He points out that there are three, Exodus mentions three distinct places that are the sort of organizing symbols of the book. Egypt, which he says is, well, Egypt is one, the wilderness is the second, and the promised land is the third. Those are the three distinct places that are the organizing metaphors or symbols of the book. So Egypt, he says, is water, which is a little surprising. You think of Egypt as being a desert country, but actually Egypt has the Nile, and the Nile is what makes Egypt a great civilization, because the Nile floods and the farmland is fertile. So Egypt is the Nile, but also it's very important in the story because Moses, and some etymologies say Moses means the one taken from, saved from the water, but Moses is cast into the Nile, right? Because of the decree to eliminate all the firstborn Israelites. So he's hidden in the Nile and found in the Nile. And then when the people escape from Egypt, they escape over the water, right, through the Red Sea. So water, Alter says, is the what Egypt means. And they, as then the people escape to the wilderness, which is why they complain so much, because Egypt was much better, you know, than the wilderness. But the wilderness is a powerful and a terrible place. That's the place where you encounter God. Wilderness is a big deal, you know, in our tradition. You're wandering around lost in the wilderness. And Rabbi Lu used to say, well, you know, we don't even need to go into the wilderness and get lost. We can just sit on our meditation cushion, and that's the wilderness for us. Because that's the place where you encounter God, and it's not necessarily always pleasant or easy, just like our experience on the meditation cushion is not always blissful, but it's always significant. Wilderness is where all the important things, all the formative things happen. It's where we find God in a very scary encounter. It's where we get our instruction book from God about how to live. Also, details about how to make the sanctuary that we can carry around with us wherever we go so that we're always ready to directly encounter the divine. We'll never be out of touch with God. And then the Promised Land, this imaginary place of peace and plenty that has been promised out of love and devotion, the connection between ourselves and the divine. The Promised Land is the manifestation of that. But it has always impressed me that at the end of the five books, we're not in the Promised Land. We're about to go into the Promised Land. And also, equally impressive, if not more impressive, is the fact that Moses, our great leader, the greatest prophet who ever lived and will ever live, can't enter the Promised Land because of his sins. Shemot begins with the names of the 70 people who went down to Egypt, but very soon, within a sentence or two, the 70 people grows to a multitude, and the words used are, they swarmed the land, these people. They multiplied so quickly, they swarmed the land like insects. There were so many of them. Very strange, this use of the word swarmed, which I think echoes in Genesis, the beasts and animals swarming all over the earth. And then it says, after some generations, the contributions of Joseph to Egypt are totally forgotten, and the new Pharaoh is uneasy about all these swarming people. But did you ever think about it? Like, they were there for a long time. Why didn't they become Egyptian? What prevented them? I mean, they didn't have, you know, the white, I mean, they weren't yet, right? Didn't yet have Sinai and all the things that we think of as identifying Jews as Jews. Why didn't they become, just disappear into the, that's always happens, right? People, I mean, they just merge with one another. How did they remain separate? Why did they remain separate? Maybe they didn't remain separate. But the Pharaoh saw them as a threat, so naturally he enslaved them. And this is just exactly what's going on in the world now, right? Where you have leaders, and maybe some of the ordinary people who enable those leaders, see people coming from somewhere else in great numbers, swarming all over the place, and they think, these people are going to overtake us, just like the Pharaoh said. We got to get rid of these people. We got to get the ICE guys out there and get rid of them because they're swarming all over the place, and we won't even recognize our own nice culture. I mean, it's very familiar what happens there. And that makes me think, like, what constitutes a people? We are this people, not that people. What is that? What are we talking about? And the more I think about it, the more harder it gets to understand. What makes a people different from other people and threatened by the existence of other people who they say are not our people? How did we get that? Where did we get that from? Anyway, 400 years of slavery. Moses is born, saved from the decree of death, and then he becomes not only an Egyptian, but an Egyptian prince. Moses is like an Egyptian prince. He's not raised in the bosom of the community. He's like the prince of the non-Jews, Moses. This is, to me, amazing. The greatest leader and prophet of the Jewish people is an Egyptian, right? Pretty much. But he seems at the same time to have the heart of a Jew, I guess, is a compassionate and a fierce heart. Because otherwise, why would he be so upset to see a Jew beaten by an overseer, so upset that he kills the overseer? He kills him deliberately because his anger got the best of him. So this is the first terrible and tragic thing that happens in Shemot. We find out that Moses is a murderer. That's the first important thing that he does. He murders somebody. So this is the leader of the great leader of the Jewish people, the greatest prophet of all time. Robert Alter says this about Moses. And this is not quoting him directly. The great general rule in Exodus, and again in Numbers, when the story continues, is that what is of interest about the character of Moses is what bears on his qualities as a leader. And now here's his qualities: his impassioned sense of justice, his easily ignited temper, his selfless compassion, and his feelings of personal inadequacy. This could be a portrait of a lot of people we know, maybe even some of us, right? I mean, remember how Moses is very inadequate. No, I can't do this. There's no way, right? And then Alter says this, which I didn't know this or think about it. He says, alone among biblical characters, he is assigned an oddly generic epithet. And this is a quote, the man Moses. None of the other patriarchs or matriarchs are called the man this or the woman that. But Moses is called the man Moses. And Alter says, there may be some theological motive for this designation in order to remind us of his plainly human status, to ward off any inclination to deify the founding leader of the Israelite people. But it also suggests more concretely that Moses, as forger of the nation and prince of prophets, is, after all, not an absolutely unique figure, but a person like other persons, bringing to the soul-trying tasks of leadership both the moral and temperamental resources and the all-too-human weaknesses that many of us possess. So that really made me think. And I never had the thought before, you know, of imagining oneself as Moses in the story, or imagining oneself as Moses in one's own life. And because that seems to be, from what I'm reading in Alter, the intention of the story is to say Moses is not, you know, Moses is not like one of these Greek leaders, super strong, you know, the greatest horseman and swordsman. Moses is like a very, very flawed person. I mean, even to the point of committing the greatest sin of all, if that's so. So that's, I've always been impressed by that, by the figure of Moses. Very relatable. So Moses runs away. I mean, he could have not run away and said, I did this because I'm defending my people, let my people go. He could have done that. But no, he's like slinks away because he doesn't want to be caught and prosecuted. He slinks away to the wilderness where he sits down near a well. Seven daughters are at the well watering their animals. And some shepherds come to drive them off. And there's Moses. He seems to be absolutely unable to stand it when stuff like this happens. He could have, I mean, after all, he's a fugitive, right? He could have, like, just sat there and said, I don't want anybody to notice me. But no, he drives off the shepherds and then waters the animals of these seven daughters, and then one thing leads to another, and he's married to one of them. And they have a son, Gershom, meaning sojourner in a foreign land, stranger in a strange land, as Robert Heinlein used it for a book title, Stranger in a Strange Land. So Moses is a fugitive and a stranger who, as far as he's concerned, is forever going to stay in this wilderness. And so all of that is the preliminary to what happens next. And here, this is what I think is the actual beginning, after the preliminaries, the actual beginning of the stories, which happens at the end of chapter 2 of Exodus. This is the very end of the second chapter of Exodus. And it happened, when a long time had passed, that the king of Egypt died and the Israelites groaned from the bondage and cried out. And their plea from the bondage went up to God. And God heard their moaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the Israelites, and God knew. That's the beginning of the story, I think, when something happens to God. God learns something that apparently God didn't know before in the way that God learns it here. Compassion. It's God's compassion that is what this story is about. And then these very famous and colorful verbs. The Israelites groaned and cried out. They're suffering, and out of their suffering, I mean, they're totally powerless to do anything about their suffering, but they groan and they cry out. And then God hears, and God remembers, and God sees, and God knows. Famous verbs. God heard the moaning. God remembered the covenant. God saw the Israelites. But it doesn't say what God knew. It just says God knew. It's the same word, da'at, that Adam knew Eve. Also the word you say when you wrap the tefillin around your ring finger, da'at et Adonai, to know God. It's a profound sense of intimacy, cleaving. So that's why there's no object here, because there's no cleaving. Eliminates two separate objects. There's two separate objects, but yet they become one object. That's something that we really appreciate when we're sitting on our cushions, and for a second there, we disappear, and there's nobody there but God. Well, so I think Moses was compassionate to a fault. And so God learns compassion from Moses, I think. And God defends the people forcefully, just the way Moses defended his people forcefully. And Moses paid the price. And maybe God pays the price too. No one escapes consequences, not even God. But this awakening of the compassion is the beginning of the story. And suffering, because suffering is the engine of compassion. We care when there's suffering. We care, it moves us. And we are moved to really defend and protect And then we become liberated from ourselves in our compassion and in our caring. And we learn this from God, who learns it from Moses. God cares, God sees, God hears, God understands. This whole people is moaning with bondage and injustice and oppression and crying out for help. Was there ever a time in the world when we didn't look around and see that? We're seeing it now, you know, as the, it's very beautiful to chant, you know, Ahava and Rachamim, and think of all the people in the world who need those four words. It's very difficult to be human and care. So I think if we sit here long enough on our meditation cushions, we burn through our petty thoughts. You know, they keep coming, and after a while they just sort of fall away. It takes a while. I sit there long enough, and the deeper problems that we all have surface. We live, we die, we care for one another. And there's always suffering. Somebody is always groaning somewhere. Somebody's in trouble. Whole nations, whole peoples are in trouble. And we hear their cries every day. And we would like to help. And maybe there's something we can do. And if there is, we do it. And maybe it helps. Maybe it doesn't help. But when we keep sitting deeper and deeper, we know that the suffering and the groaning will never end. And that's why our compassion will never end. The Promised Land, next year, in the land of Israel, next year, when we will be free. We say that every year. Doesn't seem to be happening. Maybe it never happens. Maybe there's always next year to say the same words again. Next year, next year, maybe next year. That's hope, you know. And hope is brilliant. Hope is bright. We need it. So we never stop saying next year, next year, next year. But right now we celebrate, we remember, we eat matzah to confirm and identify with this story and with the great journey of our people in compassion and love, this great, beautiful, inspiring, and tragic journey. I was saying before, you know, what makes a people? Nobody really knows, you know. And yet, people fighting against other people is one of the great facts of life that we so far have never gotten around. I would like to think that we don't need to fight or defend ourselves to be a people, that doesn't need to be the definition of what we are. The Seder makes a people. The Seder itself makes a people. We do the Seder because we're already a people, and then the Seder makes us a people. It's the chicken and the egg, you know? Are we Jews because of Seder, or are we Seder? Or do we do Seder because we're Jews? But the Seder, it says in the beginning, everybody's included in it, right? Let all who are hungry come and eat. We don't say, let all the Jews who are hungry come and eat. It doesn't say that. The Seder is remembering the past and the present. And the Seder is hopefulness. Because next year, we will be free, finally, next year. And next year, we will realize the imaginary in the holy land of Israel, which will become the promised land. Okay, not this year, but next year. We will be free in the land of Israel. And then the Seder is a tragedy. Drop by drop of wine on the plate. And the Seder is joy. The songs are the best, right? The best. And they're all joyful songs, really. Even sometimes when they remember difficult things, they're joyful songs. Thank you for listening to me. Let's sit for just a minute or two to feel our way into all this. And then we'll break for lunch.